2 years ago, the Surgeon General of the United States came and talked to you about the HHS Blueprint for Action on Breastfeeding. I was the chair of that committee that put the blueprint together, and it was so great that we had his help to launch it. One of the major recommendations of the blueprint was to launch a public health marketing campaign to promote breastfeeding as the normal way of feeding your baby. So we, in our office, we decided how can we spend our money over the next 2 years. We decided to focus in on that priority. We've been privileged to be selected by the Advertising Council of New York City for selection of as a sponsored campaign over the next 3 years to promote breastfeeding. This is one of the these are the people that that promoted Smokey the Bear, Don't Let Friends Drive Drunk, the Seatbelt Campaign, some of very successful public health campaigns. And so to have been selected for them for a campaign is really an honor for us and for you all. The overall goal of the campaign is to increase the proportion of mothers who are initiating and breastfeeding at 6 months of age. We're particularly interested in the very low rates of exclusive breastfeeding at 6 months. There are huge rates of 60 to 70% of women initiate, and then after 6 months, there's a huge tapering off down to 10 or 15% of exclusive breastfeeding. So the campaign is focusing on lifting that rate at 6 months. Now, how did we come up with the creative for the campaign? We actually went around the country in November and December. We went to New Orleans, we went to Chicago, and we went to San Francisco. And we interviewed expectant mothers, first-time moms, grandmothers, and dads. We interviewed formula feeders and breastfeeders to try to find out what campaign slogans and what would work the best in a media campaign. Half of them were African-American and half were general market audience because we're really concerned about the low breastfeeding rates in African-American women. And what we found from these focus groups was really interesting. The first thing that I think is important for you to know is that both breastfeeders and formula feeders felt that formula was this gold standard and that breastfeeding was like adding a vitamin to what they thought was the gold standard. Most of the women felt that breastfeeding was something extra and was not really the gold standard for feeding your baby. So one of the major things we're going to do in the campaign is try to reverse that and let women know that breastfeeding and breast milk is the best nutrition, the gold standard for feeding your baby. And that's why the slogan for the campaign is going to be, babies were born to be breastfed. The other thing that we learned from the focus groups is that women knew about the health benefits. I mean, they could even report some of the benefits almost as if they were reading the blueprint for action on breastfeeding. But it didn't drive them to breastfeed. It wasn't motivating enough. And so what we've come up with, and we believe that from the focus groups, they basically told us that the totality of all the health benefits in and of itself is really important, and that's motivative. And focusing on the consequences of not breastfeeding is the way we're going to go. Now, what does that mean? We're going to basically be telling women what the risk is. We're reversing all those risk ratios, those benefit ratios, and that's all statistical mumbo-jumbo to you, but it's amazing to me that this is one field of public health where no one has talked about the risks. We talk about the risk of smoking and heart disease and lung cancer. We talk about the risk of obesity and diabetes. Why haven't we been talking about the risk of not breastfeeding? I don't know. But that's what we're going to do. So we're going to talk about the higher likelihood of diabetes, of weight problems, of childhood cancers, of ear infections, of diarrhea, and hospitalization for respiratory diseases such as asthma and pneumonia. And so you'll see those messages at the bottom of the ad with statistics assigned to them. And the statistics are very compelling. And when you present those to women, they begin to say, oh my gosh, I really didn't know that. And it's surprising that they haven't translated benefits to a risk for their baby. But I need you to do that, and I need everyone in the country to start talking about it. So that, thank you. Yeah. Now, this is a 3-year campaign. How are we working it? Well, this is a public service campaign, which means it's up to the TV and radio stations to show the ads. The one advantage we have with the Ad Council is that they are a prestigious 50-year organization, and when a TV or radio executive goes to the shelf to pull an ad, they're more likely to pull an Ad Council ad than any other ad on their shelf. They get reminded every 3 months about the ad. They get we're targeting 210 major media markets. Each one of them gets a slick package that has the TV ad in it. We also target all of the radio stations in those same media markets with a slick package that describes the campaign. We're also going to do cable, internet advertising, bus stop shelters, newspapers, magazines, and billboards. Yeah. All right. It's obviously up to those TV and radio stations to put them up, but in order to help us do that, we've funded 18 community demonstration projects around the country. Very small level of funding, $25,000 contracts, but they're actually responsible for talking to the PSA and radio executives and newspaper people in their country. And some of you are here in this room. I'll read some of the names of the towns that we're in. Plus, we've trained over 300 people during the month of June who were interested in the country and talking to their TV and radio and newspapers as well. We did two-hour trainings, and Gina Chanye, who is a public health advisor with us, has been conducting those. She's up here on the front. And so many of you have gone through that training. But the idea is to get some momentum. Let the TV and radio stations know and newspapers know that we want those ads played. And so this is where you can help, and many of you are helping already. The other thing that we're focusing on besides the consequences is we're trying to empower women. We found in the focus groups, and you all know this, that women who breastfeed were more confident and more self-assured. And there was a mistake in one of the focus groups. There was a breastfeeding mom who ended up with the formula feeders. And so when the formula feeders started talking about, oh, it hurts and it would be embarrassing and I can't do this and it's too hard, the breastfeeding mom said, well, that's not true. This is what happened. So by the end of the focus group, all of the formula feeders said, you know, I think I'm going to try that the next time. So that's what you guys do, peer counselors. And we know that works. We have to let women know that they can do it. And so inherent in these ads will be some confidence-building sort of implicit messages as well. Now, what's going to be on the ads? We're going to have a phone number. We're going to have 1-800-994-WOMAN, which is our phone number nationwide. It's our National Women's Health Information Center. And we're going to have our website, We actually have a huge set of breastfeeding resources on our website, www.forwoman.gov. The Lahti League has been instrumental in training our telephone helpline support. In fact, Kathy Barber, who's here, who's a peer educator, has worked with our helpline operators since last August to train them to answer breastfeeding calls and to refer them on to Lahti if they need one-on-one help. So you all are really an integral part of the response team for the campaign, and we really thank you for that because we think women are really going to need it. And thank you. Now, the other thing that is important to know is how will the campaign be measured? How will you know it's successful? Well, we've got 3 years, and what we want to do is increase the breastfeeding rates over and above what they are increasing now. They're increasing about 2% a year, and we'll be looking at that. We're also going to be doing individualized monitoring in these 18 community demonstration project areas. And we're also, the Ad Council itself does a national survey to monitor how many people basically hear the campaign, recognize it, and how many TV and radio spots are played and what the listener audience is. When I did that radio tour recently in March with Michael Jordan's mom, there were actually 19 million people who listened to it, which was tremendous. And this was just a morning tour. We went to 25 radio stations, called in, gave 5-minute interviews. And so you can see the impact of radio and television in a campaign like this. We'll also be doing special projects with it, video news releases, perhaps something on Lifetime Television or some other type of format over the next 3 years. So it's not just, whenever we launch it, it's not just a one-time thing. We want to have activities going on over the next 3 years to keep reminding people about breastfeeding. In fact, if you want a successful campaign, you have to do that. You have to have interviews. You all need to be interviewed. Breastfeeding moms who are look good on television, which all of you will, need to be able to talk about your breastfeeding experiences. Get your doctors, if they're well-spoken, to be on television as well. So it's really a terrific time for us, and we really look forward to working with you. For those of you who want to know where our CDPs are, they're in Atlanta, Birmingham, Boston, Camden, New Jersey, Chicago, Kansas City, Knoxville, Tennessee, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Philadelphia, Portland, Oregon, Providence, Rhode Island, Pueblo, Colorado, Rosebud, South Dakota, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. What can you all do? Well, the first thing you can do is become a peer counselor with the Lahti League if you aren't one already, or get your friends to be one, because we're going to be referring women to you all to help other women. You can actually work with your breastfeeding coalition if you aren't doing it already in your area. That's real important. Thirdly, I need you all to talk to your employers and get them to set up breast pumping rooms that are friendly and sanitary and safe in your workplaces, because we hear that this is a big problem. And one of the major barriers in terms of getting the duration rates up is that women don't know that you're supposed to exclusively breastfeed for 6 months. They base duration on going back to work. No one in our focus groups knew the 6-month exclusive breastfeeding duration. And finally, if you find that the PSAs aren't being played in your area and you don't hear them, you don't see them in the newspaper, then I'm going to have you call Gina. And she will help you figure out ways to get them up in your area. So we look forward to this exciting time, and we love partnering with you all. Thank you.
thank you, Dr. Haynes, for all your efforts on behalf of mothers and babies. Just a brief reminder before we continue. Please be extra careful on the escalators. We have had someone fall. This was an adult, not a child, so that means even us moms need to really take it easy out there. Now it's time to turn our attention to Dr. Lawrence Cohen. Dr. Cohen is here to help us as parents to join children in their world, to help us become effective, enthusiastic parents. Sometimes this can be a challenge, and any light on that can be shed on the subject is greatly appreciated. Dr. Cohen.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here. Can't see all the way back there. I think normal people have favorite movies and favorite novels. I have favorite psychological case histories. And my all-time favorite is a case of Sigmund Freud's that's called The Rat Man. And this was Freud's affectionate name for this young man who came to see him. He called him The Rat Man because he was obsessed with rats. And it's actually, for a lot of you, might be very interesting reading because The Rat Man and Freud became obsessed with toilet training through this psychoanalytic case. But if you're Sigmund Freud, then after you die, someone publishes every word you ever wrote. And so someone published his case notes for the Rat Man case. So when he got home at the end of the day, or actually he saw his patients in his home, but at the end of the day he would sit and write notes on every one of his cases, and usually they were very long and involved. But one day, all he wrote about the Rat Man was one line, and he wrote, "He was hungry and was fed." And so for years, scholars have been debating whether this was meant metaphorically, whether the Rat Man came and he was needy and sad and upset and Freud comforted him and reassured him, or whether he was hungry and he had his housekeeper there fix him up a plate of sausages or whatever. And no one knows for sure. It was both. But all of us here know the power of attachment and connection to nourish a child. I tend to think that it was probably metaphorical, but who knows, could be either way. But I think of that a lot when I'm working with parents, working with children, playing with children, that simple line, "He was hungry and was fed." We know that we feed hungry children when we love them and give them affection and attention and approval. And we know how nourishing it is for them when we have that loving gaze, that gazing into each other's eyes, that embrace, we fill them up. We're a home base for them. You know, we saw this reunion of the lost child and a mother, and that's one function that we serve for children all the time, is to be a home base for them to explore out from and come back to. As they get older, we have bedtime stories. We have a hand-in-hand walk. We have heart-to-heart talks. Fewer and fewer of those sometimes as they get older and older. You go and cheer at their games. We have that kind of heartfelt connection. That's the basis for attachment. Yet we all know also that that connection eludes us sometimes. That deep connection breaks down, especially as children get older and older. We have an inconsolable baby. We don't know what to do for them, and we're exhausted, and we don't have that sense of calm, relaxed togetherness with them. I have a toddler who's in the middle of having a big temper tantrum in the grocery store, and maybe we're embarrassed or we don't know what to do, and that puts a gap between us and them. We have fights over bedtimes or over doing chores. They slam their door and go to their room and sulk. Siblings fight each other, and we lose that sense of attachment and connection. So how do we get it back? How do we get reconnection with our children? I think that play is the best way back, the best bridge we have back to a close, connected togetherness between a parent and a child. I was talking yesterday. I met a man who was here at the conference. He said that his wife had been a leader for almost 40 years. And I was telling him a little bit about playful parenting. And he said, oh, you mean like when I would lay down on the floor and my kids would crawl over me and we'd call it the monster game? And it's like, exactly. That's exactly right. Playful parenting is a way to enter a child's world on their terms, to do things their way, to foster closeness, connection, and confidence. Play eases the stress of parenting for us, and it releases the frustrations of childhood for them. Unfortunately, when we need it the most, and when they need it the most, we're often the least likely to play. We don't really feel like playing when we're upset and angry and frustrated, or when they're climbing up the walls and destroying things. And we've also forgotten a lot about how to play. So I want to give a few stories that illustrate what I think is the essence of play and why play is so important and some of the deeper purposes of play. The first, of course, is just to get down on the floor and have fun and to act goofy. Whenever I talk with parents, people will say afterwards, I don't know if I could be as goofy as you are, and I'm not sure whether that's an insult or a compliment, but I decided to take it as a compliment. But in addition to just having fun together, there are several deeper purposes of play that I wanted to talk about. The first and most important is to connect and to reconnect. If you've ever seen those National Geographic specials about chimpanzees, one thing I learned watching those, I always love those, is that chimpanzees fight a lot, but they're really great at making up. And one of the ways that they'll make up after a fight is they'll play a tickle and chase game. And they'll tickle each other really gently on the palm, and they'll chase each other, and then they catch each other, they'll tickle them. And I think that human beings do this also. We'll play as a way to reconnect, share a laugh, share something fun. But we can use play to reconnect even when there's a deeper kind of disruption also. And my favorite story about this is when a boy named Sam came over to play with my daughter, and they were about 6 years old. And Sam immediately found the only toy gun that we had in the house, which was the squirt gun that was hidden in a closet up around the corner or something. He went right to it somehow, like radar. And he came into the living room where I was sitting, and he aimed it at me. I could tell he watched a lot of television because he had the look that's like, I have a gun and you don't. And he was holding at me and aiming at me, and I knew it wasn't loaded with water because I hadn't heard the water running, so I figured I had a few seconds to think about what I was going to say, what I was going to do. And I said to him, I don't know where this came from, but I said to him, oh, Sam, you found the love gun. And he looked at it like, ugh. And I said, oh, yeah, Sam, when I get shot with that, I have to love the person up who shot me. And he was sort of surprised, and he squeezed the trigger of the squirt gun. I said, oh, Sam, and I went chasing after him. He dropped the squirt gun and went running out of the room laughing. So I was chasing him around the house, and then my daughter picked up the squirt gun, and she shot me. And so I started chasing her around the house. And for some reason, I always sing Close to You by the Carpenters when I play this game. So I'm singing Close to You off key. I won't sing it here for you, but so they're taking turns shooting with the squirt gun and saying, stop loving me, stop loving me, and they're laughing, having a great time. So we played this for about a half an hour. They went on to something else. Then a few weeks later, Sam came over again, and I had completely forgotten about this whole thing. It was just out of my mind. And Sam immediately goes, finds the squirt gun, comes into the room where I was, and aims it at me, and I said, don't aim that gun at me. I don't like to have guns aimed at my face. And he said, but Larry, it's the love gun. So I said, oh, right, the love gun. So we played that game again. So then I remembered it, and I wrote it down so I wouldn't forget it. And since then, I've played that game a lot with a lot of variations. The next big purpose of play, back to my National Geographic specials. I guess I watched a lot of these when I was a kid. But if you watch lion cubs wrestling and jumping on each other, most people think that they're practicing out their adult roles of hunting and fighting. And children, we know, do the same thing. They play to gain confidence. They play to learn how to be a grown-up. They play to learn all the things that they're going to need to do as they grow up. They build blocks, they do dress up, they do pretend play. And very often, they can do things in play before they can do them for real. Okay, my favorite story of this I read about was a boy in kindergarten, and they had circle time in his kindergarten where you were supposed to sit on the rug and be quiet and raise your hand before you said anything, and he couldn't do that for the life of him. He could not sit. He could not raise his hand. He was too impulsive. He couldn't wait. And the teacher noticed after a while that during free play time, he would often want to play school. A lot of the kids would play school during free play time, and they'd have circle time as part of this game, and he could sit there, and he could raise his hand. Okay, when it was a game, he could do it. He could play it. And I think it might seem peculiar, but it's actually very natural, very normal for children to be able to do things in a pretend play way before they can do them in a serious way, for real. One of my favorite ways for all children for getting this sense of confidence and a sense of their own power is active play and rough and tumble kind of play. And I know most of you are moms, and I want to especially urge moms to get down on the floor and wrestle and tumble around and play. I think in a lot of families, that's considered the dad's thing. And sometimes moms even say, you're just getting them riled up and don't do that. I want to say there's a lot of research actually that rough and tumble play, if it's done playfully and safely, that it can actually help children develop good social skills and help them be better friends later on. And so don't just let your husbands do it. Get in and do it yourself and play and wrestle. I'll give some examples of how to do that. With dads, sometimes I'll have to tell them, you don't have to win the wrestling match. I know for myself and for a lot of men, when we were little, wrestling meant somebody bigger held you down and beat the stuffing out of you. That's not what I mean by wrestling. I was doing a wrestling game with my daughter Emma when she was about 4. And the game we were playing was she had to get past me and onto the couch. And she tried a few times. And what I like to do with young children or timid children is let them touch me with one finger and then go flying over in a funny way. And they'll laugh and laugh. And then you get up and say, you can't do that again. And they'll do that as long as they'll keep laughing, which is usually a lot of times. And then you make it a little bit harder and a little bit harder and a little bit harder as they feel stronger and more confident. So I was doing that with Emma, and we were having a good time. And at one point, she just stopped. She kind of gave up. And then she started sneaking around the furniture instead of going past me. And I let her do that a few times, and then I said, come on, try to get past me. You can do it. You can do it. And she kind of gave up. She was kind of weak and wimpy about it. So I had this great idea. I'll kind of gently taunt her a little bit into being stronger and tougher. This is another one of my brilliant ideas, you know, that didn't work too well. So I said, you can't do it. Why don't you just give up? And so she turned around and stormed out of the room, stomped out. So I'm sitting there thinking, okay, here's the great psychologist, you know, I was blown it again, and I hope nobody was watching this. And do I go after her? Do I wait here? I was thinking about what do I do next. When she comes marching into the room, she was 4 years old, she comes marching into the room with her fists up in the air, and she says, I will never give up. And she tackles me, knocks me down, runs over to the couch, and does this victory dance up on the couch. So I asked her, how did you do that? And she said, well, I went to the power room and got more power. So she told me later that there was a special lotion she pretended to put on her to give her more power. And for a long time after that, I would say to her, we'd be out walking or something, and she'd be getting tired, and I'd say, what was that thing again? It was like, I will sometimes give up, or I'll give up if it's hard. And she'd say, I will never give up. A little bit gentler introduction to wrestling, one of my favorite games is called the sock game. And in the sock game, you get down on the floor, take your shoes off, keep your socks on, and the rule is you want to take off the other person's socks while keeping your own on. And it turns into a real giggle fest. And again, you don't have to win this game. It's okay if the kids win. So I've talked about connecting through play, developing mastery and confidence through play. The next deepest purpose of play is to recover from life's upsets. Okay, I don't have any National Geographic special. I don't know if animals do this or not. But, for example, in the last big earthquake here in San Francisco, if you go to any preschool afterwards, you'd see the children putting all the toys onto a table, standing around the table, shaking, shaking, shaking until all the toys fell down and then fell off the table, laugh hysterically, put the toys back on, and do it all again. Okay, now, they're not sadistic, evil people who just wish there was another earthquake. They're working through, I call it playing through, the fear and the upset and the trauma by reliving it through play. This time, they're the earthquake. Okay? Same with going to the doctor. Send any child to the doctor, they get a shot, and they come home, and what do they want to play? Doctor. And who do they want to be? The doctor. They want you to be the patient, and I think they love it best if you go, oh, no, 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 please don't give me a shot, I hate shots. Or pretend to be, I'm not scared, and then start screaming hysterically when they come after you. And I think if children get to do that through play, they're less likely to go grab a needle and go poke their little sister or poke the cat or something. That they only act it out in an aggressive way if they're not able to play it out in a playful way. Now, this kind of recovering from life's upsets works in an everyday way also. And I'll tell a story about that. It was an email I got from a mom, and I was emailing back and forth with her about her son Tucker, who was 4 years old. And I love this story that she sent one day. So Tucker's four, and he has a little brother who is two. And Tucker's life was absolutely perfect for the first 2 years. His little brother adored him and wanted to do anything he wanted to do. Well, suddenly, the little brother was two and had ideas of his own. Life wasn't perfect for Tucker anymore. Tonight we had a really great breakthrough. It was family movie night, and for the first time in his life, Tucker's baby brother, who was two, voiced his request, which was to watch a Pooh movie. Tucker wanted to watch Fern Gully, so he had the boys pick a hand with a coin hidden inside. So the deal was they each pick a hand, one had a coin, and whoever got it right picked the movie. So, you know, somebody's going to be upset at the end of this. But that's the way they did it. Tucker wanted to go first, so I let him. When he saw that the hand he picked was empty, a major temper tantrum ensued. Tantrums for him are rare, so this was a big deal. He called his brother the taboo names, Dummy and Stupid Baby. And he yelled, I wish he had never been born. Tucker's always been very attached to his brother. The two are great friends, two peas in a pod, so we were very upset by this. Tucker ran off, refused to watch the movie, and continued with his insults from the other room. Your book was on the coffee table, so here I was trying to find the tantrum section. So, my husband said he was going to step in soon if I didn't act quickly. She says, he's been great with letting me take the lead since he hasn't had the chance to read your book yet. So, but I think I was wearing a little thin there. He was very concerned about the brother hearing the repeated insults. Anyway, I got the info I needed and went to Tucker. He yelled at me to leave and continued with the insults and then said we love the baby more than him. So I told him why we didn't like the insults and focused then on the grief he was feeling. He was very angry at himself for picking the wrong hand and hurt that his brother didn't want to watch what he wanted. He came to me to cuddle and started crying again and lamented that nothing would make him feel better. I said, oh, I think I know one thing. Let all your tears out. She got that from my book. So he continued to cry. Then a few minutes later, he told me he wanted to take an only playing bath. That was one of his relaxation activities. No soap or shampoo allowed in the bathroom. And he said he wanted to be alone. I helped him get the tub going, and then he said, you might want to check in on me soon to see if I'm feeling better. So I did a few minutes later. When I returned, he told me he wasn't feeling better, so I needed to stay. This is where it gets good. Yeah, I already liked it pretty much, but this is where it gets good. He has a new toy seal. It's very small. Fits in his hand. He was playing with this in the tub. Then he pulls out this large T-Rex. Only it's so powerful, he says, it breathes fire. He told me the T-Rex was so angry, so I asked the T-Rex why. T-Rex said, because Tucker loves his sealy more than me. So I told Rex to ask Tucker about it. Tucker laughed and said, of course I love you both the same. I'm just spending more time with Sealy because he's new and needs me to take care of him. A few minutes later, he brings out this Styracosaurus. And, you know, you get to know all these dinosaur names when you have a four-year-old. The Styracosaurus is angry because the seal and the T-Rex woke him up. So I asked the Styracosaurus, why are you so angry about that? And he said it was because he was having the best dream of his whole life. I asked what the dream was about. I was dreaming I could have everything I wanted in life, and now I woke up and I know it isn't true. Then Tucker turned to me and asked why life had to be that way. So that's my Tucker story about using play to recover from life's upsets. And I want to turn there from the purposes of play for children and talk about your work as educators and supporters of parents. I'll start with the story of my friend Eileen. This is my friend who has three children, and she calls me periodically for parenting advice. And she called one time and asked me a question. I don't remember the question, what it was, but I gave her my 2 cents worth about what I thought she should do. And there was a pause, and she said, that's what you told me last time I asked you this question. And so I said, well, did you try it? There's another pause. And she said, well, no. So we both laughed, and you know, I said I wasn't going to rack my brains with anything new until she tried the last thing that I had suggested. But it helped me realize that that incident helped me realize that I think often as parent educators, we think that we just need to give the right information to people, that all people need is information. But actually, I think that that's very rarely all that's needed. There's some missing ingredients before people can make use of any new good information. That maybe even information is the smallest part of what we have to offer. That when I started thinking, okay, what else do we offer besides good information? And I think these are things that are much more important and deeper. Things like inspiration, encouragement, remembering that they're doing their best even if they feel bad about their own parenting, admiring them for their successes and where they're doing really well, holding the baby so they can have a rest, taking care of the kids so they can have a rest. Another thing is teaching a language of, I think of it as teaching the language of attachment and loss to parents. Often parents inherit a vocabulary about children and child rearing that they didn't really come up with on their own and isn't really the most useful. I think we all inherited this vocabulary about behaving and misbehaving. Instead of, is the child feeling connected and attached with us, or do they need to be filled up? I use this metaphor of the empty cup. Children have an empty cup inside, needs to be filled up. And when they're running on empty, they either race around trying to get a refill, or they steal something from somebody else's cup, or they do something else that signals that they're on empty. And then what do? We punish them, push them away, go to your room, and they get emptied even further. And most of all, what we do for parents, besides give them information, is listen to them. Give them a chance to talk. And this is why I feel strongly that I think every parent should be a member of a support group. I think every parent should have, you know, for years and years, should be part of a support group and be able to say, what's going great? What's hard? What's difficult? What are the challenges and struggles? This same friend, Eileen, called me up one time and asked me if I would teach a class for parents who always feel like they're on the edge of losing it with their kids. So I said, oh, I'd be happy to do that. Why don't you ask your friends and get together a class? And she said, well, none of my friends would want to be in a class like that. I'm the only one whoever feels like that. I'm the only one I know, whoever is on the edge of losing it. I said, well, why don't you just ask them anyway? So she calls me up 2 days later. I have 6 people. We want to have a class. They all thought I was the one who was never going to lose it with their kids. So these moms came to this class, and we met for a while, and it was really fun for me. Because they would come in saying, I want tips, and I want information, and I want to know what to do in this situation. And I would say, okay, we're going to come to the tips in a little bit. And I would kind of stall a little bit, and, you know, I'm going to tell you what to do later. And by the end of the class, they went home thinking that they had learned so much. And really, I hadn't been giving them tips at all through the whole class. They had just been unloading their backlog of feelings, and they had been sharing with each other what goes on, the times that they feel like losing it. They had been saying for the first time to anybody that sometimes they go out for diapers and never want to come back, things that every parent feels sometimes, but we don't usually share. And that made them free to think more creatively and think more effectively. And they'd go home and they would try new things. And they'd say, wow, that, you know, I learned so much in that class. Well, I didn't mind taking the credit for that, but it wasn't that I was telling them what to do. So if I could sort of sum up all that in one sentence, it would be that children need to play and parents need to talk. So children use play the same way that we use talking to each other. They use it to work through all of their feelings and their upsets. I've been deliberately saying parents here instead of mothers, even though I know that most of you are mothers and most of you work one-on-one and in groups primarily with mothers. And I've been saying parents partly because I'm a father and I don't like feeling left out, but also because I think we don't, as parent educators, I don't think we spend enough time thinking about fathers. So I want to say a few things here about fathers. In your work with new parents, you get to meet a lot of new fathers, and I think you're very lucky about that, to meet fathers at that time in our lives, because becoming a father often gives men a window where tender feelings are allowed. And a lot of us are raised where tender feelings are not acceptable, not okay. Or maybe a little bit, but the having a baby just opens them wide open. We can't help it. Fathers just fall madly in love with their children and are just sort of opened up emotionally by that whole experience. I think what happens is that fathers are both men and parents, but we have a lot more practice being men. Get a lot more training in that than in being parents. So a lot of what we learned as men gets in our way of being a good parent. There have been some studies of men with crying babies. And they did a study with young men. They were college students. And they had them in a room, and they had all kinds of horrible noises. Fire engines and grating saws and crying babies. And crying babies was the worst. And they couldn't stand it. You know, the one test was they could hear this noise as long as they could, and then they'd shut it off. Well, crying babies was the worst. They had another study where they just had booze out there. This is, I don't know, people, I guess, volunteered for this study to go drink all they wanted and listen to tapes. So they found that these college-aged young men, when they heard crying babies, they would drink. Okay? Because it's such a horrible sound, and because as fathers, we just feel like there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do about it. When I was saying during lunch, I had a father's group when my daughter was a baby. A group of us met as a father's group. And all these other fathers, as soon as a baby started to whimper or cry, they'd say, I got to get this baby home to nurse. And after a while, I started saying, well, when did that baby last breastfeed? And it would be 15 minutes ago or, you know, 10 minutes ago. I said, well, let's just, you know, stay here a little bit longer. I don't think they're going to starve in an hour. And so I became the crying baby holder. And And over time, I talked to some of these guys later. I got together with some of the men that I'd been in this father's group with 13 years ago. And we were talking about it, and several of them said that it was a real eye-opener for them to learn that they could comfort a crying baby. That it's not the same as breastfeeding, obviously, but that this was something that had never occurred to them that they were capable of doing, and that there's an incredible bond, as you know, that comes with comforting a crying baby. Let me tell one more story before I close up, and it has to do with connection again, and using play to bridge that connection. And this time, it's not the child feeling disconnected, but the parent, in this case me, feeling disconnected and using play to reconnect. When my daughter Emma was about 3 and 4, she was obsessed with Ariel the Little Mermaid. So she had seen the Disney movie, she had the dolls, she was just totally obsessed with Ariel the Little Mermaid. And this is all she wanted to play. And I would play with her some, and then I would get really bored. And I would try to give her a little lecture on feminism, and that just went, I don't know why, it just went right over her head. And I would try to say, well, could we do something besides dress them and undress them and have a wedding? And that's all she wanted to do. And I found myself just, it's like forcing my eyes open, and it was not pretty. And that's, you know, but she'd always want to play that. And I wasn't sure what to do. She was her favorite game. I couldn't stand it. So I was talking with a friend of mine, and just complaining about it. And Emma wasn't around, and I was complaining. And she said, well, it sounds like you're kind of on the verge of having a little temper tantrum about this. So she encouraged me to kind of let it all out, you know, kind of like Tucker's mom did with him, like, you know, let all those feelings out. So I started saying how I wanted to smash Ariel the Little Mermaid, and I couldn't stand that game, and I was, you know, I was playing pretend. My daughter wasn't there listening to me, so I was saying, this is the stupidest game in the whole world, and I can't stand it. So I started out really mad, and then by the end I was laughing, and I finished the phone call, and I went and found Emma, and I realized in that phone call, through that, after this temper tantrum of my own, I realized that I'd been telling her, in effect, I'd been saying, your favorite game in the whole world is stupid and boring and sexist. And she didn't get the sexist part, but I think she got the message that I thought her favorite game was stupid and boring. And I realized I wouldn't want somebody to come to me and say, your favorite thing in the whole world is stupid and boring. So I went and found her, and I said, let's play Ariel the Little Mermaid. And she looked at me, she was very suspicious. And I said, no, really, let's play it. And the only thing that was different was I decided to just have a little extra enthusiasm. I figured for 15 minutes, I can be enthusiastic about anything. So I was extra enthusiastic, and we had a great time. And within 5 minutes, we weren't just dressing and undressing the dolls and having weddings. We were having rock and roll concerts and flying them around the room and throwing them down the stairs and doing all kinds of great stuff with them. So we had a great time, and this ended up being one of our favorite games to play together. I call this learning to love the games you hate. And I recommend it very highly. There's something similar with, I hear from moms of boys most often, which is, my favorite one was a preschooler, and the mom said, my son's favorite game is to rip the heads off his action figures and hurl them down the stairs and make explosion noises. So I said, yes, sir, what's the question? And she said, well, how do I get him to stop, obviously? And so I knew she wasn't going to like my answer, which was, play it with him. And she said, I couldn't play that game. It's so violent. It's so aggressive. It's so terrible. I said, well, if you say that game's terrible, don't play that, I can't stand that, I don't want to see that, then he gets the same message that my daughter did in reverse, which is your favorite game is terrible horrible, violent. But I say, if you play with him, if you get down on the floor and you're pulling the heads off and throwing them down and making explosion noises, then you can say, oh no, Frankie, you lost your head, we have to call the paramedics, and we were best friends, and I gotta rescue you, and we've been through so many battles together. Well, there in like 1 minute, you've introduced these themes of rescue, loyalty, friendship. You know, you really... So you can't transform the play in that way without getting down on the floor and playing it with them. So I'll end with a quote that I found when I was doing research on play. A guy, I don't know who he was, is Austin O'Malley was his name, 1915, and he said, when you're dealing with a child, keep all your wits about you and get down on the floor. So thank you very much.